Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'd like to begin by talking about the propriety of the two summary judgments in this case and the Court's construction of the business license tax ordinances that underlie those summary judgment decisions. But first, about the summary judgments. As the Court knows, when it considers the propriety of those summary judgments, it has to consider them on the record at the time existed at those judgments. So you can't look at anything that happened later, anything that happened to trial, just on that summary judgment record. And when the Court does, it's going to see that CenturyLink didn't effectively controvert a single one of the city's facts on summary judgment. We talked about this a bit at the first appeal in this case. But if the Court will look at CenturyLink's evidence, it'll see that the affidavits don't comply with Rule 7404. They're not made on personal knowledge. They contain speculation. They contain legal conclusions. And in some cases, they're invalid on their face because they weren't properly notarized. So if the Court looks at that, I don't think you'll have any trouble upholding the summary judgment on those records. But let's talk about the city's licensing tax ordinances that underlie those decisions. CenturyLink is subject to gross receipts tax in each city because of its business in each city. It's the telephone company in each city. So CenturyLink falls within the business license tax of each city, which taxes a type of company, a company that provides telephone or telephone exchange services in the city, and the gross receipts of that company from or derived from that same service, and that's for the privilege of doing business in the city. CenturyLink isn't in any other business in any of the city. There's no evidence, and in fact, that was admitted by CenturyLink. That's the only thing CenturyLink does in these cities. It's the telephone company that provides telephone service or telephone exchange service. So every dollar of revenue that CenturyLink earns in those cities is taxable without deduction. Now, those ordinances are unambiguous. Courts have no trouble understanding what ordinances mean by telephone or telephone exchange service, and that the evolution of the services provided by a telephone company are within the ambit of those same ordinances.
What is the meaning of exchange in that ordinance?
It means essentially the same thing as a telephone company, Your Honor, and it means whatever services that a telephone company provides.
So you are suggesting that the plain and ordinary meaning of the ordinance gives no meaning to exchange. If you take it out, you reach the same conclusion.
I do, yes.
And aren't we compelled to interpret it to give it some meaning?
Well, I think the meaning stems back from the 40s when these ordinances were passed, and that's what telephone companies did. And sometimes they were referred to as telephone companies, and sometimes they were referred to as telephone exchanges. But of course, since that time, telephone companies do a lot more, and they provide a lot more services, and they earn a lot more revenue from those services. And of course, the point of City of Jefferson City Singular Wireless is that cities don't have to change their ordinances every time. And so when telephone companies morph from a switchboard to the current technology, cities didn't have to worry about passing their ordinances to keep up with whatever new technology is on the forefront.
So addressing this further, if I understand opposing counsel's argument, it's that the term exchange, telephone exchange, has a particular meaning in the industry, not that it's ambiguous, but that it has a certain meaning. And you're saying that's a current meaning, but at the time the ordinances were passed, it was a different meaning?
It does, but it's a common meaning, Your Honor. There's no technical or term of art to that. I mean, I know that CenturyLink says that because cities can't possibly understand, I guess, what these...
Well, what either one of you rely on for that, as opposed to just arguing about it?
Well, I think what I rely on from that is that if the Court is going to construe these ordinances, just as the Court below, it has to look at the plain meaning of those words. And the plain meaning of those words is evident. It's in common usage and it's in the dictionary. There's no particular technical meaning to those.
They say there is, so how do we resolve that, I'm asking you?
Well, I mean, they say that there is, but there's no evidence that whatever sort of meaning that CenturyLink or even the industry wants, a self-serving definition they want to make about those, had anything to do with what the cities meant by their ordinances. I mean, in fact, that's even contraindicated. If there's some sort of a technical meaning, Why would the cities know about that meaning when they pass these ordinances?
And these ordinances were passed approximately how long ago?
Let me see if I have the dates of those, Your Honor. I don't have the dates of those, but they've been in existence for quite a while.
Thank you.
Your initial statement was in the 40s. You estimated the 40s.
Well, I don't know that they were all passed in that. A lot of the business license taxes around the state were at the time, and sometimes those were amended, and sometimes they weren't. So I don't have the dates where these particular ordinances were passed. I know that it is in the record, Your Honor. So, accordingly, the trial court correctly construed the ordinances as a matter of law without regard to extrinsic evidence, just as the common rules of statutory construction require. Now, because CenturyLink is a company that's taxable under each city's business license tax, CenturyLink has to pay tax on all revenues derived from those businesses for the privilege of doing business in the cities. There's no need, and it is wrong, to parse those revenues further, and there's no need to analyze specific transactions or receipts that comprise that revenue. This construction and operation of business license taxes is supported by 60 years of cases from this court, like Ludwig's and Laclede Gas and Gray Bar and Susie's Bar and Grill. And the rules from those cases are well known. The license taxes assess a percentage tax on defendant's gross receipt without regard to the makeup of the revenue. That's Susie's. There's no need for an analysis of each receipt of revenue to determine whether the received revenue is taxable. That's Susie's Bar and Grill and Ludwig's. And the tax, these business license taxes, are imposed on the whole and entire amount of the receipts without deduction for the privilege of doing business in the cities. And that's Ludwig's. And May Department Stores is not contrary to those cases and, in fact, supports it. It's CenturyLink's favorite case, and they like to say that May Department Stores stands for the proposition gross receipts from what? Actually, that's not true. May Department Stores stands for the proposition gross receipts from where? The only thing that May Department Stores held was that it related to a department store that straddled two cities in St. Louis, U City and Clayton. And the only thing that May Department Stores found was that a city couldn't tax revenue from wholly outside the city. It did say the city could tax revenue that arose in both cities. And of course, that's consistent with Kansas City versus Gray Bar, that allows a city to tax a business located in a city, even though a portion of the business is carried on or a transaction is factually completed outside the city.
Counsel, I don't want you to run out of time. I know you've got 4 minutes left, but would you discuss the constitutional issue in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. In terms of jurisdiction?
Special law.
Special law, yes. I think that CenturyLink has waived that, Your Honor. A party has an obligation to assert a constitutional challenge at the earliest opportunity in a motion to dismiss.
Did they raise it in their answer?
They did. But
we have a case saying that's too late?
Yes, okay. I do. And those are in the brief, Your Honor. It's not a special law because the class members could change. The cities could repeal or amend the ordinance. Even if the court finds it's a special law, it's justified. Union Electric versus Mexico Plastic stood for the proposition that a substantial justification is to preserve those municipal revenues. If the court does find that it needs to modify it, it could simply strike the date. The court has an obligation to strike the minimum amount of the law necessary to make it constitutional.
Would the effect of that be that all cities can adopt these?
It would. But, I mean, as long as they provide the credit for the gross receipts taxes. So that's an important point. If the court can't do that, I think the court would have to strike all of SB 369, which is 67-1830 to 67-1846. The court can't presume beyond a reasonable doubt that the legislature would have passed that without the grandfathering provision. The grandfathering provision was put in at a conference committee. And so, the presumption from that is that but for the addition of the grandfathering clause, there would be no SB 369. Have I answered your question, John?
Yes, thank you.
You raised a lot of issues in your brief about whether or not the court properly addressed liability during the trial or just damages. But to the extent that this is a legal issue, we're always going to be looking at that on appeal and re-looking at that issue. So how are you saying there's factual matter in the record that was not previously there?
Well, what I mean by that, Your Honor, is that when a court enters a partial summary judgment, those issues should be decided and over.
I understand
maybe
that,
I misunderstood
that argument,
your question.
But it's a legal question on summary judgment. If there's a factual issue, you go to trial. So whether or not, I'm just trying to understand the prejudice you're saying arose, should the court have, I mean, the court can always reconsider legal issues that it's determined previously until there's a final judgment. You're saying you were misled into believing that that would not be an issue at the trial, but if it's a legal question, then I'm not clear what evidence you're saying you would have put on or how that affects our review on appeal of whether that legal decision was right or wrong.
I think that the summary judgment is, of course, composed of factual and legal issues. And so, but once the court enters a summary judgment, the court can change it, but only with proper notice to the parties. I mean, a fundamental notion of the integrity of the trial process is that when you show up for trial, you have to know what issues you're trying. Rule 7404.
I guess what, just asking, what would you have done different if you had been told that I'm still thinking about this issue?
Well, of course, that's speculation and a hypothetical, but let me do my best. The cases say that.
We need to do that.
the cases say that you know, first of all, you don't have to do that, Your Honor. But if the court would have said that liability is still a live issue in the case early on, I imagine we would have done more discovery about that. We would have gotten witnesses.
It's always, my point is, on appeal, it's always going to be a live issue because we get a look and see if that was a correct or incorrect interpretation of the law. So, and you're stuck with whatever record you made. So I'm unclear how you were harmed since you would always be being reviewed on appeal by the record you made.
But the proper record on appeal is the summary judgment record, Your Honor.
Yes.
And so not anything that happened later, because once
you're saying it's unfair for us to look at anything additional that may have been added during the trial on that issue, not that, of course, we do look at whether summary judgment was correctly granted as a matter of law, and you don't get to add more to that on appeal.
I do think it's unfair, because the rule and the law is very clear. That when a court enters a summary judgment, those issues are removed from consideration. There are cases in my brief that say that. There are cases that say the court can't consider even evidence relevant to that.
But even if we accept your argument that it is error, that the court should not have done that, you have the burden of proving prejudice, which I think is what Judge Powell's question was. We don't speculate whether there's prejudice. We need something to tell us how you were prejudiced by that.
I don't think prejudice is the standard, Your Honor, because, and I mean, how could it be? Because in this situation, if a party obtains a summary judgment on an issue, and under the rules and the relevant law, that issue is supposed to be removed from the case. And so the party
does. But counsel, what we're saying is it's never removed from the appeal. They get to appeal that decision, and if it's right or wrong, and we're going to look and see whether it was legally correct or legally incorrect based on the other arguments you make in your brief. It's unclear how it really affects our review. I understand your concern about what happened and at the trial, but the legal issues are going to be the same however many times they're considered.
And I think the court's review should be, is the summary judgment correct on the summary judgment record?
Right.
And then, I think what the court should do is say that none of the evidence that the court accepted was admissible for the purpose of liability, because those issues were already determined. And so.
And how would that affect our decision on the law here?
Well,
anything that came in at the trial, was it sort of more of the same? I know they had various witnesses talking about how they interpreted what their particular ordinances meant and what could be included, but that was also the issue previously. Is that a legal question?
It wasn't exactly the issue, because the court made a decision as a matter of law of the construction of the ordinance. And so when it does that, it doesn't look at extrinsic evidence. And so none of that extrinsic evidence should have been admissible, not only for the meaning of the ordinance, but for CenturyLink's liability under the ordinance.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yeah,
Counselor, you're 3 minutes over your time, but thank you for responding to the court's questions. We'll save all your time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Excuse me. Good morning, and may it please the court. In May Department Stores versus University City, this court posed the precise question in the text of the opinion that the circuit court here committed a reversible error by not asking, which is gross receipts from what? The fundamental flaw in the city's attempt to rewrite their ordinances to increase their tax base is that they misapply the term gross receipts as the answer to the May Department Stores question, and they have to therefore ignore the express terms of the rest of their ordinances. Gross receipts is not the answer, it's part of the question. Just as this court in the May case did, the answer is found in looking to the language of the ordinance. Gross receipts merely establishes, and the cases that the cities rely on merely establish, that the taxpayer cannot deduct expenses from the revenues that are subject to tax. Gross receipts is distinguished from net profits. But to find out what services gross receipts are taxable, the court should have looked to the language of the ordinances defining the services being taxed. It did not, and that was error as a matter of law.
I'm looking at, for instance, the one in Cameron, and it says, every person engaged in the business of furnishing exchange telephone service shall pay the said city on an annual license tax 5% of the gross receipts derived from the furnishing of such service within said city.
Correct.
Opposing counsel's argument is that the extra money, the access fees and so forth, you got because you furnished service within said city, and therefore it's part of the gross receipt.
And that's a misreading of the statute. What they're saying is that because it's a gross receipts tax as opposed to a net profits tax, you ignore the rest of the language.
I'm asking why this language doesn't support their argument.
Because it says
gross receipts derived from the furnishing of such service.
That's right.
Telephone exchange. Why was the access fee you got from other companies because they needed to access your local exchange service? Why wasn't that derived from the local exchange service?
Because it isn't furnishing such services. That's the key language in the ordinance that you just read.
It's derived from furnishing such service. So how was that not derived from furnishing such service?
It's derived from selling wholesale a service to an inter-exchange carrier like AT&T. It isn't derived from providing such services.
Why did they want to buy it from you?
So that they can provide service in the city. So the key part there is that where it says such service, it's referring to exchange telephone service.
Right.
So it's from furnishing exchange telephone service. That is a technical term. It does have meaning.
To derive those other forms and other categories of revenue, though, don't you have to have an exchange? Don't you have to be the exchange telephone provider for the city?
No.
So you could come in and just do long distance and not do... Not
sure. For example, AT&T. That's what they do. They're not the incumbent local exchange carrier in the city. They provide long-distance service, and they have to acquire the ability to use a portion of the phone company's lines in order to do that.
Accessing the lines is not the same as accessing the exchange telephone service, you're saying?
It is not providing such service, i.e. exchange telephone service.
But is it derived from that?
I'm trying to
get you to address those words, derived from, which I'm not sure that you have.
No, derived from furnishing such service, being exchange telephone service, that means that we are liable for tax for providing something called exchange telephone service. And the question is, what is that? And in the case of in the case of Wentzville, the language is furnishing telephone service. What is that? And they are different things. And as you asked in the first argument, you asked, well, what do those terms mean?
Right.
And you have to know what those terms mean, because those are the services that are subject to the tax, because those are the ones that where the revenues are being derived from furnishing exchange telephone service.
This one was adopted in 1962. Do we look at what those words meant at that time? Or how do we determine the meaning of
it? Well, why wouldn't we look at what they meant during the time that the ordinance was provided?
The meaning of those terms.
Isn't that a common rule of statutory interpretation, that you look at the words of what they meant in the context of the time that they were passed?
There is no evidence in the record that those terms have different meanings today than they did when they were passed.
That's a different question, though.
The answer to your question is yes. You do look at the terms in the context in which they're written. When they're technical terms, you do understand what the technical term is. Counsel, for example, referred to looking at the dictionary. We provided the court with the dictionary. In telecom, Newton's telecom dictionary is the dictionary, and we provided an affidavit from Mr. Newton explaining what is exchange telephone service. We basically got Webster to give the definition of something. What is telephone service? And they're different things, and we paid differently. We paid Wentzville on a different, broader tax base because of the fact that telephone service means something different from exchange telephone service. We acted consistently, and our witness at trial testified that he reviews thousands of these around the country, has to understand what they mean, because he has to set up the payment regimen in such a way that it is paid pursuant to the specific terms of every jurisdiction that we do business in.
For us to consider the evidence you've just referenced, do we have to find that the language in the ordinance is ambiguous?
Absolutely not. The reason.
So how do we get to that evidence? Isn't it extrinsic evidence?
The evidence that I just referred to of the witness from CenturyLink was introduced for the purpose of establishing that we had a reasonable basis for the way we paid, because they're seeking penalties, which under Missouri law requires a finding of unreasonable. I should say it the other way around. Under Missouri law, if the basis on which you paid is a reasonable basis, then you're not subject to penalties. And so we introduced evidence on the penalty issue of that. But you can look at the express terms and understand them in the context, yes, Judge Fisher, in terms of, or Chief Justice Fisher, I'm sorry, in terms of what they meant at the time, but also what they mean in the context and custom and usage. And the only evidence in the record is what we presented on that, because they elected not to put forth any evidence on what any of these terms mean. And they did that because they're adhering to this idea that if you say gross receipts, then you put a period, full stop, and the rest of the ordinance gets disregarded, and that is not the law. Ludwig's doesn't say that. Laclede doesn't say that. Susie's Bar and Grill doesn't say that. In fact, in Ludwig's and Laclede, which they rely on most, the ordinances aren't even recited in the opinions, because it wasn't an interpretation of the ordinances that was at issue even in those cases. What was at issue was the question of gross versus net. In Ludwig's, the question was whether there could be a deduction. In the case of Laclede, the company took in revenues but had to remit them, and the question was, well, do they have to pay tax on what they took in even if they have to remit it back? And this court said no. So, but the issues in all of those cases are gross versus net. That's not an issue in our case. We paid on gross. We didn't deduct anything. So that's not the issue here, yet that's the issue in all of their cases.
So what did the trial court find in terms of, did the trial court find that these terms had a special technical meaning, or did the trial court find they were ambiguous, or?
The trial court did not find them to be ambiguous, ruled on them as a matter of law, and simply got it wrong.
As a matter of law, did the trial court find they had a common meaning or a technical meaning? You're arguing they had a technical meaning in the industry.
Yes.
Did the trial court agree with that, or did the trial court reach that issue?
The trial court didn't reach that issue.
So we don't know.
We don't know. But this court, sitting as an appellate court, is to look at the language and understand it. And you can look at the record as to find out what it means in the industry custom, what those terms, which are technical terms, mean. And you could conclude that they're not technical terms. But you should look at the record, and all of the evidence in the record supports that exchange telephone service is a technical term and it has a specific meaning.
Does your argument depend on that, or do you believe you win whether it's technical or not?
We believe whether it's technical or not, because they had the burden of establishing that the damages that they were seeking arise from revenues we derive from furnishing exchange telephone service, or in the case of Wentzville, telephone service, and they never attempted to do that. And they didn't do that because they want to adhere to this idea that if it's gross receipts, you don't look at gross receipts on what? So they, so no, we do not need to, it doesn't matter whether the court did that or didn't. This court can make that determination from the evidence in the record. Now, I want to address the constitutional issue and the grandfathered political subdivision. 67.1846 is the grandfathered political subdivision, and it is an unconstitutional special law under the Missouri Constitution. There is a case, City of Springfield versus Sprint, that is directly on point and is dispositive of the issue. The question is there a closed-end class based on an immutable characteristic such as a cutoff date? In City of Springfield, it was a cutoff date. In this case, there is a cutoff date after which no one can join the class. If you have not created a linear foot fee ordinance by May of 2001, you can't ever join that class.
Can members of the class leave?
Of course, members can always leave from any class, but that's not what defines whether it's closed-end or not. In fact, in City of Springfield, if that were the rule, then City of Springfield was wrongly decided because they could have left in that class too. You can always leave a class. The test is, can you join a class? And here, you can't unless you have a linear foot fee ordinance in place by May of 2001. So it is clearly a closed-end class, and it is clearly based on an immutable characteristic, a historical fact, in this case, a particular date.
Springfield says that just makes me presume presumptively unconstitutional, and that when there could be justifiable reasons why that they approved that. And then there seems to be kind of an obvious justifiable reason here that, hey, we don't want to destroy, you know, tax base for some city that
may rely on. Yes, and Judge Powell, they raised that in their briefs. There is no evidence in the record to support that. That is argument of counsel. There is no evidence that the cities would necessarily even lose any money, depending on the outcome of some of the issues in this case, because there's a credit for business license tax paid. It could turn out that those business license taxes exceed the amount of the linear foot fee. There is no certainty that the cities will lose any revenue at all. And this is all just pure argument of counsel in their briefs. Furthermore, it's their burden to put on evidence to support a justification of a facially unconstitutional law, and they didn't even attempt to put any evidence in. Now, they rely on the idea of severability, and they say, well, you could just sever the date. The problem, of course, with that is, as was pointed out, all that means is that the ordinance, which is to prohibit the charging of linear foot fees for utilities to use the right-of-way would become inverted and suddenly would be an ordinance allowing any city to do that. It would take the intent of the statute and completely put it on its head if you did that. Or what it would do would be to replace one date with another date. Instead of May of 2001, if you took that out, as they proposed, just take the date out, then it would basically be as of the date of the ordinance. And you would still have a closed-end class. Anybody who has a linear foot fee and then dot, 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 no date, is grandfathered in, well, then that means presumably as of today. You would still not solve the problem.
And under what authority can we change the date in a statute?
I don't see how you could change the date. That would go against the legislature's intent. They intended to grandfather in as of a particular date. If you severed the date out, instead of severing the provision out, then what I'm saying is you would simply replace it with another date, effectively, the date of the ordinance, by effect, not by expressly writing that in.
You can't do that.
I'm saying you can't do that. And I'm also saying if you did...
I understand you're arguing they didn't put in evidence of substantial justification. We've recently said that's a factual issue. If this court were to find either that it's not a special law or there was a substantial justification, do you then owe $500 today?
I'm sorry.
Did your clients owe $500 a day under the POW?
No.
The ordinances? Why not?
No. You're asking about the penalties?
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, there would still be no penalties due. There was, first of all, no evidence to support that there was any kind of misconduct that would result in penalties. Second, three of the cities have penalties that say up to an amount, and Wentzville, the one that just says 500, is essentially a criminal statute ordinance. It refers to conviction, imprisonment, and I think that the court, and most importantly, the court made no finding in any of the summary judgment orders or as, after trial, there's no finding whatsoever of a basis for penalties. No penalties were awarded in the first summary judgment, no penalties were awarded in the second summary judgment, and no penalties were awarded in the final.
Your argument was within the trial court's, because the trial court did find it was a violation, but in its discretion found no penalties?
Correct. That's right. And in its discretion, based on the fact there was no evidence of any of the kind of wrongdoing that would give rise to penalties, and in fact, all of the evidence was from us as to the reasonable good faith basis for why we paid the way we did, even if the court disagreed with our understanding or interpretation of exchange telephone service and telephone service. Nonetheless, it implicitly found that we had a reasonable basis for it because it awarded no penalties. If I could just conclude by telling the court what it is that we're seeking in terms of relief. Four things. First, that the tax base is established by the express language in each governing ordinance, and what services are included are the ones that were presented in the evidence on summary judgment at trial, and they presented no contrary evidence. Judgment should therefore enter for CenturyLink on all claims relating to the payment of business license taxes, as that undisputed evidence was that based on the correct interpretation of exchange telephone service and telephone service, that's what we paid on, and we paid that correctly. Second, that Oak Grove's contract with CenturyLink, Ordinance 1145, is the governing tax ordinance applicable to CenturyLink, not the general ordinance 615. Third, that 67-1846 is an unconstitutional special law. And fourth, that Cameron and Wentzville's requirement of a contract to operate in the right-of-way is an illegal mandatory franchise. And I make the final observation that if the court agrees that the ordinances mean what they say and that the Oak Grove ordinance, Oak Grove contract applies, the court need not reach any of the other issues on appeal other than the two right-of-way issues. That would resolve all of the other issues that are on appeal. And so unless there are other questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you.
The ordinances here tax a certain type of company within each city, and CenturyLink is that type of company in each city. And because it is that type of company in each city, it taxes all the revenue that CenturyLink receives as that type of company, a telephone company or a telephone exchange company in the cities. If CenturyLink was in some other business, it wouldn't reach those because that business isn't covered under the ordinance. But there's no dispute here that that is the only business that CenturyLink is in those cities. And that's why the ordinances tax every dollar that CenturyLink receives in that city. And carrier access is a good example of that. Carrier access is revenue that CenturyLink receives from others for the use of its business in each city. What happens is that a telecom often wants to complete a telephone call within a city. To do that, it needs to use the exchange in the city, CenturyLink. So CenturyLink has poles and wires and facilities in the city, and so CenturyLink essentially lets the other company use that and charges for it. They wouldn't get any of that revenue if they didn't have their business in the city that's covered by the ordinance, the exchange. So that's why the summary judgment evidence was that CenturyLink admits on its website that carrier access revenue results from CenturyLink being a local telephone company and providing local exchange service. That's in the legal file at 7942 to 7943. Even the FCC describes carrier access as local service revenue. That's in the legal file at 7954.
I'm sorry,
go ahead.
If we find that the ordinance has two reasonable interpretations and could be interpreted either way, what rule of construction governs then? Do we find the ordinances interpreted in favor of the taxpayer or is there a different rule of construction?
I think that there is a different rule of construction. This isn't the kind of ordinance that is strictly construed, Your Honor, and I think those cases are in my brief.
As I understand, you both argue it's unambiguous. You just both argue it's unambiguous your way.
Isn't that always the way, Your Honor? but yes.
Your Honor claims it's ambiguous and should have extrinsic evidence of what these words mean.
If it was ambiguous, then the court would correctly rely on ambiguous evidence. But I don't think that's the case. And here, some discussion about the evidence that the court took in. That's not relevant for penalties. Penalties have nothing to do with state of mind, as we explained in our brief. It has nothing to do with intent in this situation.
They do certainly sound criminal, though. They talk about fines or imprisonment
That's one basis for them, Your Honor. The other is that people simply violate the statute. And as I explained, there are cases that point out you can properly recover those in a civil suit. So it's not just criminal.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time is up.
Thank you.
It was a well-argued case on both sides. Mm-hmm.